We'll call the Agriculture Rural Development Committee meeting to order. We are having a few technical difficulties with the audio, I believe. As soon as that's back, as you know, the Ag Committee always starts on time. Doesn't mean we do anything, but we do start on time. So that being said, we will recess until we have our proper audio. And then we will, for all the members that are not here, we have three items today. The first will be Representative Heigerkin with an overview on a possible bill that he's looking at. And then we will go to a bill, and then we have Dick Hemmingson from the University of Minnesota. And we'll go from there. So we will be in recess until we have our proper audio. Okay, we will bring the meeting of the House Ag Committee back to order. The first item, folks, if you look at your agendas, we have a David's bill, and then we have Representative Heigerkin, and then Mr. Hemmingson will be making a presentation. We're going to change the order just a bit here. We're going to start with Representative Heigerkin, a presentation regarding application of sales tax to livestock equipment. When we do have a quorum, we'll officially call the meeting to order, and we will take a look at the minutes and some housekeeping issues. But with that being said, Representative Heigerkin, welcome to your Ag Committee. If you could please start your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, just so we know what's going on here for the people that, the members that are here and the people sitting out in the audience. As we know that the State Department put on another 200 people. The governor did, but trying to get some of the sales tax, et cetera, issues addressed. And because of that, I have found within my own district that there's a lot of audits going on. I've had 7 implement dealers in my district that went through an audit. I've had farmers, a good number of farmers, call me and say, we're going through an audit. And it's not the auditor's fault, it's not the tax division's fault. They're just trying to do their job. And before we start, we had a discussion for the last hour, Representative Davis, in our office. We've been going over some of the gray areas within the tax code. And there are a lot of gray areas. And what we have found, and I've talked to the auditors that were in our district as well, that work for the state of Minnesota, they have been very cooperative. We're all on the same page, and I think we started our discussion on the same page, and we're going to keep it that way. We don't want to sit there throwing punches at each other. We're just trying to give clarification and to basically allow the farmer and let the implement dealer know where they're at. At the same time, you've got a lot of the small implement dealers maybe competing with, and I don't want to mention names, Corporate America, that have lawyers sitting within their corporate offices. They sometimes can do things that the little guy can't. And because of that, the little guy won't get the sales tax exemption, the big guy does because he got the attorney there defending them. With that said in mind, what we're going to do is I've got, and they'll introduce themselves as we go around the table. They're going to introduce themselves and bring forth some of the problem areas that we have. And again, it's where we have the state of Minnesota's on the same page as we are. We're just trying to get clarification, and yet at the same time, we're going to come up with, when we're all said and done, some areas in which we think that we may need some legislation. And at this time, I'm hoping that Chair Davis will carry the legislation that we may need. And I visited with Senator Vickerman, and he said, if whatever Chair Davis carries, I'll carry in the Senate. So I think we have a good starting point. With that said, I'm going to let Lee pick my chair, and then we'll have a discussion. I thought, Chair, that we probably would limit it to about 45 minutes and then go on from there. If we run out, and if we finish before that, so be it. Okay? With that in mind, I'll let you introduce yourself, and we will start the discussion then from there.
Thank you, Representative Heigerkin. If you could please introduce yourself for the record, whoever would like to start.
Okay, my name is Representative Bud Heigerkin, and we will turn it over to, over here, Rich Strom.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Rich Strom. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Minnesota Equipment Dealers Association. Do you just want to introduce now?
Welcome to the committee. Would you like to start? Or?
Sure, I'll start. Representative Heidkirchen is absolutely right that there's been a number of audits of farm equipment dealers in the last couple years. It appears that the Revenue Department has stepped up their efforts to check on the sales tax collection procedures of the dealers. The dealers are not at all opposed or find the audits antagonistic, but we do find that there's a lot of confusion as to what is supposed to be taxed and what is not supposed to be taxed that a farm equipment dealer sells. We've had some audits come back with as high as a $100,000 tax bill, and usually that's been not negotiated down, but they've ironed out the differences in some of the items that the department thought should be taxed, and so they've become a little bit less than that. But there are a number of areas that are, I guess I would call, gray areas in the sales tax code. The department has a fact sheet that they've developed from the legislation that's in place, but there's a number of items that the farmers think should be non-taxable, and the dealers are kind of caught in the middle of whether they should be collecting tax on those items or not. And I'll just mention one of them before I pass it on here, and then we'll open up the discussion with the four of us up here. But one issue we ran into a couple years ago was a dealer was audited, and a number of large mowers that he had sold to farmers to use on CRP acres were he didn't charge tax on, because they were for, in his opinion and the farmer's opinion, for farm production. The Revenue Department took a different approach to that and said anything that's used solely for CRP acres is not considered agricultural production. There is no product that's actually sold. Well, the farmers have signed up for this government program, and they have to, according to the program, keep the weeds mowed down on these CRP acres, and so they buy these large mowers to do that, and the Revenue Department has denied that as an exempt piece of equipment. That's something that we would like to see changed either through the rulemaking or legislation. And I'll just leave it at that one issue for now.
Well, Mr. Strom, couldn't the farmer have argued that when they release the CRP round for hay that there is production?
In that case, I guess they probably could have, but to my knowledge, the department did not accept any. If that was the case in these particular situations, the Revenue Department evidently did not accept that. And that doesn't happen all the time, that those are released for hay production.
Okay. Thank you. Who's next?
Mr. Chairman, representatives, my name is John Beringer. I own an equipment dealership in Sauk Center named Dairyland Supply.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. Just to reiterate what Rich Strom has said about mowers, before I get on to the specific item I want to talk about, during our audit, we were treated very well, and I feel fairly, by the Department of Revenue and by the auditor. We had no problems or issues with him. But on the item as such as a mower that Mr. Strom is talking about, we also do sell those mowers. And because of the CRP ruling, tax was due on those mowers. But we also sell those same mowers to farmers for maintaining their pastures, to control noxious weeds and control the growth of certain things in the pastures. The auditor came back and said that the Minnesota Department of Revenue said that those were also to be taxed, that was not considered within the realm of agricultural production. So as you can see, that's just the beginning of a lot of gray areas here that are open to different interpretation. Excuse me. The one particular item that I would like to key on are calf hutches used on dairy farms. clearly, as most dairy farmers and farmers look at what is taxable, what is tax exempt, many times it says that it is equipment or items that are related directly to the health, the well-being, the rearing, the raising of animals for production. Clearly, calf hutches on dairy farms are known to be and proven to be something that dairy farmers need to have to continue to raise healthy calves to build into their herds to continue the dairy operation. So calf hutches are clearly something that farmers believe should be tax exempt when specifically it is written in the tax code that it is a taxable item. So we've had an ongoing discussion with the farmers about that, some of them have refused to pay the tax before we had the audit. Others now they will sign the tax exempt forms and things like that. But calf hutches certainly are one item that I should be think should be open for discussion as far as something that is important to the production of animals on dairy farms.
Thank you very much, John. Before we continue, and we can have questions here too if members would like. Before we continue, we'll officially call the meeting of the Ag and Rural Agriculture and Rural Development Committee meeting to order, March 14, 2006. Representative Welty, after thoroughly studying the minutes, moves the minutes. Are there any questions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevailed. Okay, with that, we will continue. Who would like to go next?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Greg Heck, and I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue working in the sales tax area.
So you're the guy.
I'm the bad guy here, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman. Basically, we're dealing with two statutory exemptions, and they're found in 297A.69. There's one for items used or consumed in agricultural production. These are basically the fuels, chemicals, sprays, these types of things that are consumed in one-time use. And then also in 69 sub 4, we're dealing with an exemption for farm machinery, which just went through kind of a history. Going back to 91 or 1981, it was taxed at 4%, and in 98 it went to 2%, and 1 year later it went to 1%. And starting in 2000, though, we totally exempted farm machinery in Minnesota. We had the same type of phase out for repair and replacement parts for farm machinery. Just the area of controversy is what is farm machinery, because what the statute specifically says is the farm machinery is implements used directly and principally in agricultural production. And I guess it comes down to those words, directly and principally. The department would be the first to admit that we've had to draw some lines here in defining what is directly and principally used in agricultural production. And as a result of that, we've issued fact sheets, two fact sheets, fact sheet 100 and 106, which specifically list some implements, types of farm machinery that do qualify as exempt farm machinery, and some do not, based upon our interpretation of the statute. And I think some of those things are what we'll be talking about today. In order to claim these exemptions, farmers or persons who would buy them exempt would be required to give an exempt certificate to their vendor. Then it could either be a one-time certificate or a blanket certificate, which would cover all types of purchases to be made in the future if they were to be used for exempt purposes. The department certainly recognizes there's another controversial subjects in this, and we'll be talking about some of those today. Some of the ones that have come specifically to my mind, or we've had a number of questions and calls on, relate to fencing. Statute specific provides that fencing does not qualify. The legislature only extended that to survey fencing a couple years ago, but that's fencing that's about 8 feet tall, and certainly it's not the type of farming that would use in most type of livestock raising. The statute also specific provides that snow blowers do not qualify as farm machinery. There could be some difference of opinion of what the legislature intended there, but the wording does say that it does not apply to snow blowers. It also specifically does not extend to snowmobiles. We have extended to ATVs when they're used specifically for agricultural purposes. There have been a number of questions in the past relating to types of implements used for watering and feeding animals. Up till 1991, I think the statute provided that feed bucks did not qualify as exempt equipment. After that was removed from the statute, the department then extended their exemption to all types of water tanks, stock tanks, all types of bale holders, any type used for watering and feeding livestock. One of the problems that we've encountered over the years is the statute seems to be drafted and intended mainly at small grain farmers. It really doesn't specifically address some of the concerns, I think, of the livestock industry. And that may be one thing that we want to, that the legislature may want to look at in updating the statute, is addressing it more specifically to livestock, because the statute is more drafted towards the grain farmers, I believe. At that point in time, I'll end my testimony, and I'll certainly be willing to take any questions further on.
Okay, we'll go next to, I believe, Mr. Lee Larkey.
Yes.
Retired IRS agent.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, yes, I'm a CPA and a retired Internal Revenue agent. I've got one general statement here, because it's not something you may be able to do with legislation today, but I do think it's important. I have a client currently under examination, and it has to do with this person has his own gravel pit and sells gravel, delivers the gravel. And the argument is, when the gravel is delivered, is it delivered in place, in its final resting place? If so, it constitutes an improvement to real property and is therefore not subject to sales tax. Examination started in last March. January 27th, the new court case came out and changed the whole set of rules. Up until that time, it was believed by the taxpayer and by the Department of Revenue that final resting place meant that no further spreading of the gravel had to be required. If, let's say, a truck were to dump the gravel along the road, it would be considered its final resting place if no other equipment had to move that gravel in any substantial manner. It would be arguable, possibly, that somebody took a shovel or a hoe and did a little tiny bit, that would be considered final resting place. But now, on January 27th, a new law was basically passed, if you want to put it that way. Our courts did it. So we now have a new court case that defines far more clearly what it is we have to follow. So we go back under the examination, and the time prior to the exam, we had one belief that the tax liability is going to be based upon this court case. It seems a bit difficult to try to follow the law when you can't determine what the law is. And by the way, I went through Mr. Heidgerken's office and had the research team contact the state of Minnesota to find what the law was prior to this case. So things change, and I just want to make the comment that the laws are not very clear in many areas, and yet people are called upon to be responsible for the unclear laws. How can you follow something when you follow a law and you don't know what it is?
So did the court rule that we're taxing your final resting place? Or
well, maybe and maybe not, but they made the conditions much more stringent. You know, there's a number of situations that are quoted here from sales tax fact sheets that are in the court case. But anyhow, it says it's undisputed that the sales on which the commissioner assessed tax involve no spreading, strengthening, or other form of installation by the appellant. The appellant merely delivered and dumped the aggregate at a location specified by the purchaser for which the purchaser could not spread or install the aggregate. Hence, the purchaser, not the appellant, was responsible for any spreading. Well, it's distinguished in much greater detail as to what spreading is and what spreading isn't. But if the contractor, in writing, is given orders to bring his own bobcat and to lay everything out, let's say that the that there's an even 2-inch coverage of aggregate gravel. In this case, that would be considered a final resting place, because the person obviously did the final spreading. But the clarity, even though it's here now with this court case, was not here before. And the concern I have is, how does one follow the law when the law cannot be determined? So, my main concern is so that we can know what the law is.
Kind of sounds like campaign finance. Okay, any questions for members, for any of the four testifiers, or Representative Heigerken on the bill he's going to carry? Or that's going to be carried. Representative Heigerken.
Yes, John, I know we've got some other issues. Would you relay a couple of the other issues that were there? There's some gray areas, and I think... Greg Heck of the State Department will agree that there's a lot of gray areas, and we had a discussion an hour before this in our office, and I think we've come to some agreements in areas in which we may not need legislation. But at the same time, there's going to have to be some legislation done, and we're trying to get some clarification exactly where. Would you point some more out, John, please?
Yes, and also, or Mr. Chair, also to build on what Mr. Heck said, that it seems like a lot of the items that were written in as exempt farm machinery were definitely tailored towards crop and grain farmers. When we tried to educate our customers on what is exempt and what isn't, the dairy farmers, who is the bulk of our business, felt that they were being put at an unfair disadvantage to their crop farming neighbors on what was taxable and what is not. And just to give you an example, and I'll keep it brief, is if you look at the fact sheet 106 when you have time, the exempt farm machinery, you'll see there that seeders and seed cleaners and seed treaters and drills, and then units used for cultivation, and then units used for harvesting, combines, and things like that, basically taking that product from a seed and refining it and planting it back in the ground to grow new crops, every piece of equipment virtually that they need for that is exempt from tax. Back to the calf hutches, that's what they're doing with the calf hutches, is they're taking the baby calves that they hope to raise and put into their dairy herd for future production, and they are being taxed on those calf hutches when they feel that that's an important part of their operation. So I just wanted to tie those two together. Another item that is specifically written in Fact Sheet 106 that is a taxable item are snow blowers. I'm sure that when this was written that they thought, well, walk behind snowblowers, things like that that people use in general. But if you're a farmer and you have dairy cattle, you need a snowblower to be able to get the milk truck in and out of your dairy operation. If you're a crop farmer, you need to be able to get that grain moved to market in a timely fashion or to meet your contract. You may need a snowblower to get at those bins. If you are a cattle producer, you may need to get into those lots through some snow drifts to feed your cattle. And that's another area, snow blowers, that they feel should be exempt from tax because, again, it is a piece of equipment that is used to market their product, to take care of their animals in every way on the farm. Another thing is the fencing issue that was brought up, that you need to keep your animals restricted within the confines of their pasture for management of your herd and also so that you're not having problems with your neighbors or cattle getting out onto the road to cause hazards for highways and things like that. And farmers feel that they also should have an exemption on this fencing because it is something that's needed and some might say required in the production and the management of their animals.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and appreciate the comments we're talking about dairy exemptions. We have a bill that we'll be discussing tomorrow, right?
Tomorrow, yes.
That has qualifying expenditures for the dairy will be eligible for. And a suggestion was made a year ago that we should look at making exemptions for these tax exemptions for these expenditures. And we looked at that, discovered that most of them already were tax exempt. However, we did have some questions on some of the provisions in here, and frankly, that highlights your problem. As we are trying to determine which of these were eligible and which were not, we had some question marks, some areas that were gray areas, and we didn't know for sure on what they would fall into. And we still have to determine a few of them. So I appreciate your problem.
Any other questions for members?
Mr. Chairman, may I address the representative?
Mr. Beringer.
Thank you. Yes, that's a very good point, and that was part of the discussion that we had as a group before the meeting, was to clarify this. There's a lot of confusion out there amongst the farming population and among the dealers, who I would call the enforcers of and the collectors of this tax. I believe that if you went out and surveyed the farmers of Minnesota, a high percentage of them would say that I'm a farmer, and anything that I buy and use on my farm for the production of my crops, my cattle, things like that, should be tax exempt. And that's where the problem comes in, where the friction comes in between the farm customer and the equipment dealer, and sometimes between two competing equipment dealers because of the interpretation of that. And I guess what I would like to see would be a simplification of this, where if it in fact is going to be utilized in the production of agricultural products, something like I said with the snowblower, if you can tie it to the fact that this purchaser needs this piece of equipment because he is in the production of agriculture, not because he happens to live out in a rural area and needs a snowblower to get to work, I think if you could tie it to that and have a form that says that, yes, I'm buying this as a farmer for use in production, it takes the problem of enforcement, interpretation of the law, off of the backs of farm equipment dealers, who in fact are just business people, who are just people out there trying to sell equipment and employ people, and don't have a good understanding and interpretation of the law, because this tax code sounds to me like it's somewhat fluid. Things change from year to year as different groups get their particular product in this as under tax-exempt status. So I'd like to see something that would cover that under the production of agriculture tied to crops, cattle, dairy, hogs, things like that. Thank you.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Chair Davids. I understand and I can empathize with you. The opening statement from Mr. Heck, I can see where the confusion comes in. Because what I gathered when you talked about tax exemption, you talked about consumed and used. You used the word used also. And so right there it would tell me that anything you're dealing with on the farm, it would encompass everything that it takes to operate your farming operation. So I can understand where the confusion comes in.
Any other questions for members? Okay, thank you very much. And this was an informational meeting. Anybody else? Representative Heiger?
Just a follow-up again. And this is we had a meeting over... and these some of these folks were there. Senator Dill was there, Senator Johnson, and Senator Representative Larry Hosh was there, and Senator Fishbach. And we had a 2-hour meeting, I think, that morning. John, you were there, and it was just it goes beyond this. And there's a lot of clarifications that we do need, and we're hoping that we're going to meet with. I think we've got some agreements with Mr. Heck, and we're going to meet, and he knows where we're going to need some legislation to get, what we really want tax exempt. And there may be some areas where we just need a better clarification. But yet, what we want coming out of this is for these implement dealers right now that are going through all these audits, and the farmers, that they know what is tax exempt and what is not. And that's the intent of just having a little bit of a hearing to get the ball rolling on this.
Thank you, Representative Heiger. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen. We will now go on to, is Mr. Hemmingson here, or a representative for Mr. Hemmingson? Okay, why don't you come down and you're going to make a like a PowerPoint or something like that? Okay, let's do that, and then we'll get into the bill. And while the gentleman from the U is getting set up, tomorrow, if members could be here right at 2:30, we're going to start with the Dairy Investment Tax Credit Bill, the Erdahl Bill, and then we'll go to the Ag Nutrient Task Force report. We want to hear about what that task force came up with, and then we'll begin a discussion on House File 3441, Earthworm Junkie, and we'll probably run out of time, would be my guess. So I'm not scheduling to have a vote tomorrow, but it will come back up so we can address that further. And we did get quite a few referrals yesterday, so we've got the last week or so here. We will have quite a few bills after tomorrow. So we may be going into the evenings a bit the next week, which is the week before deadline. We're getting very close to the deadline, so... and if other members have come to me and asked for hearings, please, if you've got a bill you need heard, a member of this committee, let me know. And we'll, if I like it, we'll hear it. If I don't, we'll hear it anyways. Okay, so with that being said, oh, I better put some qualification on that. We'll give it the consideration it deserves. Okay, so with that being said, we will, we're going to have a presentation from the University of Minnesota. And then we'll get into the House File 3273, bill relating to agriculture, creating a soy-based transformer food conversion allowance program, appropriating money. So this would, of course, have to go to Finance Committee after this. So with that being said, we are almost ready.
Hager can pass his no bill. It was unanimous. I wanted a roll call. And then we'll hear your bill tomorrow, but not take a vote on it.
Yeah. Man, let's see if we run out of it. Yeah,
that's
a little funny. I don't care
to see it. Yours? It would, yeah. This is a rough
one. Okay, all set?
All set. Wonderful technology.
State your name for the record, please.
Todd Rubolt, Assistant Director with the Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment.
How do you spell your last name?
It's R-E-U-B-O-L-D.
And you're from the U?
Yes.
Okay, please give us your presentation, sir.
Chairman Davids, members of the committee, Dick Hemmingson, had planned on being here today. However, had a family emergency come up within the last couple hours, and so I'm going to do my best to work my way through his presentation here. I just wanted to start off with a little bit of background. As someone who grew up on a ranch in western South Dakota, it's a pleasure to be here before this committee today. A little bit of background. I'm sure you've all seen this chart before. Energy consumption in the U.S. and around the world is steadily increasing, and is projected to continue steadily increasing over the coming years. In addition, along with this increase of use of energy, obviously, we're seeing an increase in carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide in the atmosphere. Coupled with that, we've seen population increases that are projected to continue to increase also. And just on this chart, I'd like to point out, you'll notice the United States there in the upper right-hand corner. This graph shows the gross domestic product graph with energy consumption per capita. The thing I'd like to point out is that you'll notice China down towards the middle, and if there was a space there, you'd see India in that same area. If China and India follow the same energy path that we followed in this country, we're going to see significant energy and environmental challenges in the coming decades. So with that as some background, I'd like to give you an update on the University of Minnesota's Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment. Now, IRE was formed back in 2003 with a mission of promoting statewide economic development, promoting healthy and diverse ecosystems, and national energy security through the development of bio-based and other renewable resources from right here in Minnesota. Now, I won't read through this whole list, but just a couple of our goals and objectives that it's useful to point out include providing leadership in the research and development of these new energy technologies, creating jobs by transferring these technologies into practical outcomes, and utilizing Minnesota's vast bio-based resources. For those of you who are unaware, IRE's funding totals $20 million. We received $10 million back in 2003. It was from the Xcel Energy Renewable Development Fund, plus approximately another $2 million per year over 5 years from Xcel's Conservation Improvement Program. Once again, I won't go through this whole list, but there's a couple items from the legislative language that are important to point out. One is that IRE's research funds must be focused on processing and utilization of agricultural and other forestry, plant products, and other bio-based renewable resources. Also, we need to focus on converting the state's wind energy resources to hydrogen, so forth, the production of hydrogen from bio-based renewable resources right here in Minnesota. Just continuing with the overview a little bit, since our inception in 2003, IRE has been able to fund approximately 100 renewable energy research projects at the U of M. Now, these projects aren't only located on the Twin Cities campus. They're spread out at University of Minnesota campuses around the state and also our various research and outreach centers around the state. In addition, we place a high value on collaboration, and you'll see from this from the slide here, we've collaborated with about 40 business and industry partners, 12 other universities in the region, and approximately 50 other external organizations, both domestically here in the United States and also internationally, I should point out. Another core value for IRE and something we place a high value on is leveraging of these resources. For example, in 2005, we awarded about $11.5 million for renewable energy research, and these funds were used to leverage an additional $9.3 million from a variety of state, federal, and business and industry partners. So nearly a one-to-one match on our resources for the past year. Within IRE, our research tends to focus in a few broad categories, and I'd just like to cover those briefly here. The primary category where most of our research takes place is in this area of bioenergy and bioproducts. We also do a substantial amount of work with efficient renewable energy systems, that's your solar and wind energy research, and also hydrogen. We have some researchers looking at policy and economic studies, and in the past year we've invested funds in carbon sequestration research also. So why biofuels and bioresearch and bioenergy? Well, it's a pretty obvious answer. Minnesota is a state that's rich in bio-based resources, from our forests to our traditional agricultural practices, and looking to the future, perhaps switchgrass and prairie grass being used for biofuels and bioenergy. Within IRE, our research spans the spectrum from more basic research to applied research, and we have a number of demonstration projects, and I'll touch on a few of those in just a moment here. Overall, to date, we've invested about 75% of our resources in research projects. Another quarter of the funds have gone to demonstration, and the remaining 3% has been used for core operations, including our ongoing conference and symposia series. So now I'd like to just take a moment to talk a little bit about the different areas of research that I mentioned just a moment ago, and I'll start with bioenergy and bioproducts. This is where researchers at the U of M are, for example, looking at genetic improvement to biomass feedstocks. tackling this whole issue of a biorefinery and what that will look like, and new models, new forms of biofuels, and also analyzing this broad concept of a bioeconomy and what it means for the state of Minnesota. A couple specific examples of the type of research we're working on right now. This is Professor Roger Ruin in the College of Agriculture, Food and Environmental Sciences. And he's working on research on biomass conversion processes, and the impact of his research will be an increase in the use of agricultural and forest residue for renewable energy, fuels, and chemicals. Next, we have a number of researchers working on what we call an integrated biorefinery. If you think about a traditional refinery, you're not only producing fuels from petroleum, you're also producing chemicals and materials. So now imagine a biorefinery model where you're taking homegrown Minnesota resources and you're producing fuels, bio-based fuels, chemicals, and materials. It's a really exciting project that we're quite pleased is happening at the U of M. In addition, this project is quite interesting too. It's titled Petroleum Fuels in Real Time from Renewable Resources. Researchers in this area are working to engineer bacteria that transform common renewable resources into fuel hydrocarbons. So, in other words, the researchers will be working to revolutionize the industrial conversion of biomass to fuels by transforming renewable resources directly into petroleum in a matter of hours. So they're doing in a matter of hours what it took traditional fossil fuels millennia to accomplish. So this is another really exciting project at the U of M. In addition, we have a number of projects looking at biomaterials and bioplastics. In the Center for Diesel Research at the U of M, they're working on improved utilization of Minnesota biofuels. This research will lead to more widespread use of both ethanol and unprocessed plant and animal oils. And you'll notice this is a student researcher in the center there who happens to be working on a John Deere engine. Another one of our focal areas, as I mentioned, is hydrogen. Picture on the right-hand side there is Lanny Schmidt, a well-known researcher at the U of M. This is where we looked at converting biomass and biofuels to hydrogen, also solar to hydrogen, wind to hydrogen, and so forth. Researchers in the policy, economics, and ecosystems area are developing comprehensive state and regional energy policy recommendations, and they're also looking at such projects as carbon mitigation and carbon sequestration. And finally, the Efficient Renewable Energy Systems Cluster, where we do a lot of our wind and solar work, looking at new and innovative materials for these technologies. And I'd just like to highlight one other project here. That's the wind turbine that's located out at University of Minnesota Morris at the West Central Research and Outreach Center there. Now, in a traditional scenario, we use wind power to produce electricity that goes directly to the grid. But the thing about this project is, not only are they doing that, not only are they supplying nearly 40% of the U of M Morris's total electricity needs, but we're also working to come up with a system that will store and produce and store hydrogen from wind, from that wind turbine. In addition, and this is where it gets really great, is that you can take that hydrogen, you can combine it with nitrogen from the atmosphere, and you can produce anhydrous ammonia, fertilizer that can be used right there in the county and around the state. And you can also take that anhydrous ammonia, store it, transport it, and put it through a reforming system that will then convert it back to hydrogen that can be used at a fueling station to power a variety of outcomes, such as a hydrogen fuel vehicle when we get to that point. This recent quote from Farm Journal magazine, I believe sums it up nicely when they say that we need more far-sighted projects like the one at the University of Minnesota, where power from a 230-foot wind turbine will be stored in a hydrogen fuel cell. Researchers plan to use the hydrogen to produce anhydrous ammonia to give farmers a local source of fertilizer. This is especially exciting now, too, with the increases that we're seeing in natural gas prices, and so this is a project that we are pursuing with quite a bit of urgency, actually. So in addition to research projects, IRE also funds a wide range of education and outreach activities. We have an extensive conference and symposia series, and I should point out that on April 12th of this year, we'll be hosting a biotechnology in China seminar at the University of Minnesota, and we're pleased to announce that the head of biotechnology within the Chinese government will deliver the keynote address at that seminar. Now, much of the information I covered today is located in the annual report that was passed around in the packets that you all have. As we look to the future of IRE, we don't want to only consider this continuum from basic research to applied research to demonstration. We also need to focus on the importance of education, educating the next generation of renewable energy engineers and experts and so forth. In addition, it's important not to lose sight of the practical outcomes of all this research and the importance of commercializing these new technologies. So as IRE looks to the future, we'll remain true to our mission that I stated earlier. We also like to talk in the office about this concept of hedging your bets, that no one can predict the energy system of the future, so you need to be prepared for a multiple variety of scenarios. We'll also continue to focus on renewable energy research priorities that will help the state, and we'll continue to develop and strengthen our partnerships. Slightly longer list on this slide, but I believe it's important to recognize what we hope to accomplish in the future by garnering sustained recurring funding for IRE. We hope to accomplish, we hope to continue and expand our current programs and research portfolio, establish the U of M as a center of excellence for biofuels research, develop curriculum and outreach education in this area of renewable energy, expand the focus to include conservation and efficiency projects, and so forth. Also establishing the U as a national center for full cost accounting, building stronger linkages between research and the policy, economics, and environmental implications of that research, and so forth. Finally, in conclusion, the best way to summarize my presentation today is that IRE hopes to position, we hope to position IRE and the U of M as the linchpin for the next generation of renewable energy technology advancement, sustainable economic development, and partnerships among business and industry, government agencies, NGOs, and the university community. With that, I thank you very much for your time today, and this was just an informational session also. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to handle those.
Thank you, Mr. Rubel. Before we get into questions for Mr. Rubel, I'd like to acknowledge two folks, actually three folks in the audience today. One is Edgar Olson. You can just wave, former member Edgar Olson, who is retiring from the AURI, Agricultural Utilization Research Institute, and his successor, Teresa Spade, sitting next to him. So we welcome you two to the Ag Committee. And Edgar, I really want to thank you for your service to AURI. You did a wonderful job, and it's been a lot of fun to serve on that board with under your leadership. And also, I would like to introduce a high school classmate of mine, one of my best friends in high school, Phil Nelson, who now lives in Invergrove Heights, who works with Wells Fargo Bank. And I would just soon, if you could just wave, kind of Phil, I'd really appreciate it if none of you talked to him about our high school days, especially the press. If they're in the press, or please stay away from Mr. Nelson, if you would. Okay,
DFL that, Elections Committee.
Yeah, the DFL Elections Committee would love to talk to you. So, this is not good. This is not good. Okay, with that being said, questions for Mr. Rubold, and again, this is an informational hearing on IREE. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rubold, interesting presentation. Question that I get asked frequently, like your answer, will it be cheaper to produce renewable energy or to produce energy through renewable sources than today's fossil fuel sources?
Mr. Rubel.
Representative, Chair, members of the committee, right now wind energy is competitive, as I'm sure you know, with our traditional energy sources. Much of our research, while it does focus on the technology side of these new renewable energy systems, we're also not losing sight of the economics of those systems too, and hoping to kind of bring the two along hand in hand, not only advancing the technologies, but also pursuing these technologies from an economic standpoint and doing what makes sense. And we think with these technology advancements in the technologies, the prices and the costs will continue to come down, and so we're hopeful for the future.
Representative Erdahl? And Mr. Rubold, and for Mr. Hemmingson, I know that he had to take off, but in the governor's state of the state, the governor talked about 25 by 2025. So there's a bill being drafted as we speak to do that. So I'd better have some ideas on how we're going to get there. Okay, so we'll continue this conversation.
Okay.
Other questions for members? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we will now go to House File 3273. I will move House File 3273 be recommended to pass and sent to the committee on what? Ag Environment Finance, where that fine piece of legislation hopefully will be sent. But before we do that, to get the bill in the shape that I would like, I'd like to take the finance part out of there, but you can kind of see the number we were thinking about. But this is the Policy Committee, and I would move H3273A2. Basically, all we're doing there on page 2, line 13, we're deleting the dollar amount, and we're leaving that for a Finance Committee to look at. We want to get through the policy part here if we could. So that being said, I will move the A2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now the bill is in the shape that the author would like, so I will just take it from here. I'd like to invite the folks down that came here to testify on this bill to start out with a presentation on what we're trying to do here. I'll be very brief on just kind of an overview. You should have in your packets someplace here. Where's the summary on this? Okay, here we go. Basically, what we're doing is soy-based transformer fluid conversion program to go with fluid for transformers, electric transformers, 98% soy-based products. And we will hear some testimony. But before we do, I'd like to ask from the audience, is there anyone here that would wish to testify against the chairman's fine piece of legislation? Okay, seeing none, is there anyone that I'm not aware of that we do not have on the agenda? I have a Mr. Bob Worth and a Patrick McShane that would like to testify on this bill. Is there anyone else who would like to testify? The reason I'm asking is because we do have to be out of this room no later than 4:15. There is another committee coming in. Okay, so we'll go with the two, and then we'll have member questions, and we'll see where it goes from there. So I moved House File 3273, and we do have the amendment on, so we're not. Members can kind of see what we were looking at for dollars. That'll probably still be pretty close. But with that being said, if you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Patrick McShane. I represent a company that makes dielectric coolants and electrical equipment called Cooper Power Systems. It's a pleasure to be here today. Originally, I was born and raised in a town called Winnebago, Minnesota, of which the University of Minnesota girls basketball team has a star from this small agricultural community in Faribault County. So, I didn't imagine when I was many, many decades ago as a senior in my high school thinking about going into electrical engineering that someday I'd be sitting here at the Agricultural Committee talking about bio-based products. But I'm very pleased to be here and talk briefly about the product. Our company makes dielectric equipment, and probably most familiar to many of you are transformers that sit on poles and sometimes pad mount transformers near commercial buildings. Each of these transformers contain a dielectric coolant. The dielectric coolant acts as an insulator, and that allows the transformers to be compact because it insulates better than air. And then also, there's some losses produced in the operation of a transformer that have to get out of the inside of the transformer and transfer to the air. And so the dielectric coolant acts as the two properties, both as an insulator and as a heat transfer fluid. In the past, for over 100 years, transformer oils have been typically mineral oil, petroleum-based. Where there's consideration for fire safety, for many, many decades, they use PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls. Our company making transformers do not use PCBs because we are concerned about thermal degradation byproducts, so we ignored that market segment. But utilities came to us and asked us to produce PCB substitute fluids that would be safer for the environment and also at the level of fire safety. And we developed a petroleum product back in the mid-70s. However, we were looking for something more environmentally friendly. And so we started research in 1992 looking at vegetable oils. And we looked at 24 different types of vegetable oils, some that I'd never heard of before, to see if it'd be possible to use vegetable oils for this purpose. And lo and behold, we found one vegetable oil that had excellent properties, was cost-effective, and that was called soybean oil. And so, after many years of research and many millions of dollars that we funded ourselves, we introduced this product at the beginning of this millennium. And it had a very slow start because of the being a new technology. The fluids and transformers have to last for 20 years or longer. And so it's hard to prove that your fluid will work, you know, unless you have 20 years experience. Of course, we did a lot of testing, accelerated life testing. So what we came up with was a fluid that had very excellent fire safety, very high flash and fire point, 98% soybean oil. And then we spent a lot of time in research and development finding performance additives, enhancing additives that would not cause harm to the environment or to human health or other types of environmental or health issues. And we searched hard and long for those additives and found essentially food-grade additives in the end that function quite well. And the most serendipitous thing is it turned out that the other part of a transformer that's key to its performance is insulating paper. And what we discovered was the insulating paper lasted 6 to 8 times longer when it was aged in soy oil versus petroleum oil. And so then that got us thinking that this fluid could be used not just for the special niche market of fire safety, the PCB market, but across the board. And as there's more and more drives for bio-based substitution, as we just heard from the previous presenter, this kind of fit right into the trend for, you know, if we can use bio-based materials. The problem is, to one of the representatives' question about cost, and of course, as long as petroleum is made by nature, and it's mostly just an extraction and treatment versus planting the seeds and harvesting the seeds and processing, it is more expensive. And so one of the pushbacks we've had from some of the utilities has been the additional cost. So trying to accelerate the at least trial period and acceptance and trial use is part of what's behind this piece of legislation, I believe.
Okay, thank you. Questions from members?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it just sounds almost too good to be true, you know. But I believe you. But is it how? What's the? Help me, somebody. What's the difference in costs here? Because as petroleum products are now going up, are we? You know, how far apart are you?
It really depends on, you know, even for this application, petroleum products can range from anywhere from, if you buy huge quantities in bulk, maybe $2.50 to $3 a gallon. When you, with our fluid product right now, the price is approximately anywhere from $7 to $10, depending on the quantity. Petroleum can cost it up to $6 if you buy a very small quantity in a small container. For electrical application, it takes a special processing, special additives for a product that has to last at least 20 years in as a functional fluid inside the equipment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And did I understand right that the longevity, though, is greater with soil?
Yes,
soil?
Mr. McShane?
Yes, the insulation of the paper, the insulation life, as paper ages, it gets more brittle.
Mm-hmm.
And as it gets ages, it also produces moisture. And moisture is an enemy of dielectric performance. And so when you have a lightning storm, the probability of a lightning strike and impulse to cause a failure is greater. So you want the dielectric strength high. You want the moisture to stay out of the system. Soy oil, as do some other vegetable oils, has a remarkable capability of absorbing moisture and not allowing it back into the paper, and actually, with time, getting rid of the moisture through a chemical process called hydrolysis.
Well, it still sounds too good to be true. I mean, so it costs a little more. You got the length of time, and we have to think in long terms here. The short term stuff isn't working.
Representative Ball.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a follow-up question to Representative Pennis's question. It would seem to me, too, that there's probably a potential cleanup cost savings and some other storage cost savings with a product that doesn't have the toxicity of something that has PCBs in it. Is that true?
Well, it depends on the local regulations, but if you look at, we've spent a lot of time, a lot of money, and in fact, the U.S. EPA did it. We were one of the first utility products that went through the U.S. EPA's Environmental Technology Verification Program. It took 2 years, six figures of testing, independent of our own testing. And the thing I'm probably the most proud of as an electrical engineer being involved in this is when we first tested acute aquatic toxicity, what you use are little baby trout fry. Little tiny
thing. Yeah.
And what you do is that for 24-hour periods after they're exposed to the fluid, you look at physical harm and or mortality. When we first did our first mortality test, the acute aquatic toxicity test, we had 100% mortality in the first 24-hour period. It turned out to be a food-grade preservative. That was the cause. We didn't know it, you know, until the process of elimination. So we went back to the book, 6 more months of looking for preservatives that would help stabilize the fluid for this 20-year-plus application, but would not do harm to baby trout. We found 2 products. One was vitamin E, and the other was commercially available and not as expensive as vitamin E that has worked out well. We went from 100% kill rate in 24 hours to 96-hour period, zero mortality. So you're right about the actual impact. But for the regulations to catch up to the technology, that has been a challenge more surprising than I would have ever anticipated. As you know, anybody in the Agriculture Committee probably knows, in the U.S., you know, passed a law in 1995 called the Edible Oil Act, trying to get the EPA and other federal agencies to differentiate the environmental regulations between edible oils and non-edible oils. And unfortunately, the EPA kind of snubbed its nose at that. Fortunately, and hopefully, we see some light at the end of the tunnel, and it's not another train, but in the energy bill of last year, there was a clause to exempt soy oil-based dielectric field transformers from SPCC. Now, the intent of that clause has been published recently in the Congressional Record by the House Chair, Representative Barton, of the Energy Committee. And right now the legislative lawyers are working with the EPA lawyers trying to get EPA to acknowledge the intent of that legislation.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick follow-up. So that was a lot of information. Just to be clear, so if Representative Hamilton and I were fishing in Leech Lake and we caught a couple of walleye, could we fry it up in your oil and eat it?
It's not a food-grade material because our plant is not Food and Drug Administrative, controlled. We don't sterilize our plant, so we don't call it a food-grade material. Right. But, yes, actually I popped some popcorn in it. It was quite tasty. I didn't like the hair loss, though.
Well, now, Mr. McShane, I didn't realize that when I agreed to carry this bill that there had been animal testing done.
This is a little sample of it. We do have a green colorant. It's a U.S. trademark colorant to separate it from less, environmentally friendly fluids for dielectric application.
It has magnifying properties.
We do. You said
that green dye number 3?
Yeah, the representative said it's too good to be true. We do have 2 disadvantages with mineral, just to be honest. And one is, especially in Minnesota, a cold temperature. It is more viscous at cold temperatures. Its pour point is around minus 21. We've gotten it from minus 10 down to minus 21. We're trying to get it even lower. And it seems to be acceptable, but it might require certain operational changes if you're cold starting a unit, when it's minus 30 for several days here.
Okay. But other questions for Mr. McShane, and then we'll go to Mr. Wirth. Representative Erdo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So what happens at 25 below in the transformer?
It's a big shame.
It won't fail, per se, because it's still a very good dielectric coolant.
Just takes longer to turn the lights on?
And you know, and you don't need to cool a transformer, or, you know, cool off a transformer when it's 25 below. So it's only when you do a cold start, and some pad mount transformers, you may have some switches, and the switch operation won't meet its full rating. So we'd recommend the transformer be energized before you put on a load. In those rare cases where you're going to start up a transformer that's cold. If it's an energized transformer, the losses, the inherent losses from the core, even without a load, are sufficient to keep it in a liquid state.
Well, and
I get one request, Mr. Chair. Thank you. What about the I come from way up north. It's not the end of the world, but you can see it. Let's say a typical winter where we would have below zero for the high and 30-35 below at night. You're saying cold start would be difficult, but if it were already going, we're okay. We'd probably be okay. My question is there going to be more generation of moisture? And then how would that compare to the traditional transformer? Isn't there more moisture and the life expectancy go down on those? Under those cold conditions?
Well, if I understand the question right, I'm not sure I fully understand it. Let's see if I got it right. When a dielectric coolant, like mineral oil, it has some water in it and the temperature drops, that moisture can go into saturation, and that can reduce the dielectric strength. Fortunately, with the soy oil, the amount of saturation and the curve of the saturation, it's almost impossible for it to go into saturation at cold temperature. So its dielectric performance stays very high. It's really an advantage for cold temperature in terms of dielectric performance, if that was the question.
Okay, members, if you look on the FR3 sheet, Cooper FR3, who's using FR3? Roseau Electric's using it currently. So
hey,
that's way up there. Okay, we will now go to Mr. Bob Wirth, President of Minnesota Soybean Growers, for his presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am Bob Wirth, a farmer from soybean farmer from Lake Benton, Minnesota, and proudly serving as president of Minnesota Soybean Growers Association.
Okay, let's just get it out of the way. Who's the legislator for that area? Who's the House member for that area?
Aaron Peterson.
Okay, very good. Okay, please proceed.
Okay. I thought it was Erdahl. It's always folks from Erdahl's district that are here. So
I'm here today to talk about soybeans. Soybeans are made up of two parts, protein and oil, and we all know protein is an essential part for our animal industry in the state of Minnesota, which brings in $30 million in the state of Minnesota. And the other part of the soybean plant or product is oil, and which we have had an excess amount of. But as we all know, Minnesota is taking a lead, the big lead, and having the mandate of biodiesel, which we are very supportive of, and thank you very much. But there's other issues and uses for oil, and that's why we're here today to talk about that. I'd like to speak in support of the new product that uses soybean oil in transformer fluid. Agriculture, as we have learned, can play a major role in replacing petroleum oil, thus helping to clean up the environment, boost our local economies, and help our nation reduce its dependency on foreign oil. Minnesota Soybean Growers Association very much appreciates the support that the Minnesota legislature has given to renewable homegrown products like biodiesel. Utilizing renewable domestic resources like soybean oil can also eliminate the need to use other traditional petrochemicals, while our non-renewable, non-degradable, and sometimes toxic or cancer causing. While these types of chemicals are used to manufacture many of the products we use every day, federal and state regulations are creating a heightened demand for alternative industrial products. And consumers are demanding safer products made from natural, renewable resources. That's where, once again, agriculture can step up to the plate and offer a renewable, safe, homegrown solution. Minnesota Soybean Growers Association supports new products that create a new demand for soybean oil and environmental temp FR3 transformer fluid is an exciting and promising new use. Thus, we would urge this committee to investigate the potential of this new product for the use in Minnesota. In closing, I would like to thank Chairman Davis for inviting me here today, and I would like to thank this committee as well for their support of agriculture's role in providing safe, renewable alternatives to petroleum and thus reducing our nation's dependency on foreign oil.
Thank you, Mr. Wirth. Any questions for Mr. Wirth? Representative Pinstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I first want to express my interest in this bill, and the question I have by no means is to downplay that, but I guess it's just a pure honest question of, we're talking about a product that will replace essentially a competing product, and right now this bill is asking for some state dollars to make that fiscally competitive. So my question is, at what point, I guess I'll just put it this way, at what point will this product be able to survive on its own without a state subsidy to get producers to use this?
Mr. McShane?
Well, there's first cost and there's total owning cost. And putting aside for the moment the fire safety attributes to the public and to utility workers and the environmental safety and benefits to the environment, but just looking at it as a functional product, the first cost is higher. I think the good news is if you look at the last 20 years, the cost, if you take away inflation, the vegetable oil prices, particularly soy, have been much more favorable in terms of its cost increase versus petroleum, which in the last recent years has gone quite high. And I believe with the India and Chinese markets, we see as a company, it's really booming in the electrical sector. They're going to be taking a lot of pressure, keep pressure on commodities, particularly petroleum, which is a finite resource. But I think we have a very strong story for life cycle cost. A SMUD out in California has gone 100% with this fluid for all their distribution transformers. How do they justify it? They justify it by increased loading, getting more capacity out of the same size unit, and extended life. But I think for utilities, they appear to be kind of a conservative group in terms of change. And so they're looking at first cost due to deregulation costs is more and more of an issue, and long-term is a little harder. So we're asking for a little nudge to get them familiar with the product, and I think over time, besides the mega economics issue of trends of commodity pricing, I think that'll give us time to fully sell the life cycle cost advantages.
I don't know if you can answer this. I do see some of the electric folks in the audience, but following up on Representative Finstead's question on cost, I guess it'd be helpful, Mr. Chair, if we can get it now, but if we can't, before Finance Committee, where I also sit, to understand what it would cost Candiota County Electric Co-op, who services mostly farmers who grow soybeans, who should be using this product. What would it actually cost them in addition? I mean, how many transformers do they change out? How many, you know, and how many gallons per transformer? And what are we really talking? I mean, Representative Davids, you only had, Frank, only $240,000 across the state. Isn't a great amount, and I'm just wondering, it'd be nice eventually from our electric folks up there in the back row or others to get me an idea on a normal co-op what rural electric co-op what they would spend and use as far as gallonage and realistic costs. Because frankly, if it is minimal, I see where Finstead, Representative Finstead is going, and I would encourage my electric co-op to do it anyway. I'm one of their customers. I'd sure want them to use those products that are grown just beyond my yard, north of Wilmer.
Mr. McShane, are you able to get us any of those types of numbers? Or
I can't for any specific cooperatives. I can just say, I can give you some guesstimates. In the United States, about 75 million gallons of petroleum oil is used for new equipment and maintenance. In existing equipment, there's about approximately 2 billion. This fluid can be used and is being used for not only new equipment, but for retrofilling existing equipment to improve either fire safety, environmental profile, or extended life, or all of the above. I would say you could take your Minnesota gross state product value of the national and kind of extrapolate, maybe it uses 3 million gallons, 2 to 3 million gallons annually new, and maybe has 50-some million in existing equipment here in this state. So for any one utility, obviously it depends on how many meters they have and divide it that way.
I suppose what we could do, we could merge this with my 25 by 2025 bill and say for utilities that they'll get a 10% credit if they change out the transformers.
You're thinking. Mr. Chairman, I was going to ask that.
Oh,
I was going to ask that question. And
Griffin Blaine.
I was thinking down those same lines, actually, Chairman Davids, is would it be possible in the future, as we're asking our friends in the utility business, and we're mandating them to provide power, X percent of power in X year, coming from renewable resources, if they could get credit as an incentive to get them to switch to soy oil and in the transformers by giving them credit towards that initiative by using soy oil.
I can see another bill coming. Feeling my top priority. 23 now? Poor Mark. Oh, that's something to look at. Representative Fennis.
Yeah, well, I think we can get some amount here because in the bill, you've got that they can get $2 a gallon toward this when they use a soy-based transformer oil, and it can't exceed 80,000. So if we take a look at our co-ops, and some lobbyists can provide us with that, and there's also a limitation on the years. It's between 2006 and 2008. So, I mean, if everybody did it, we can get, a grand total and then back off from there on a more intelligent guesstimate than we make most of the time in this state.
Thank you, Representative Fennis.
Yes.
Okay, with that being said, I think you've heard clearly from the committee that they would like to, some possible numbers as to what this might actually take. So, with that, any other questions? If not, I will renew my motion that House File 3273 as amended be recommended pass and sent to the Ag and Environment Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Tomorrow again, just to repeat, your investment tax credit bill first, Erdahl, Ag Nutrient Task Force report, then we'll start on House File 3441, the junkie bill. No vote, and the reason for the no vote tomorrow is because there's some groups that have interest in this that really want to crunch some numbers and do some things and look at it closer. But it's not a no vote forever, it's a no vote for tomorrow, and then when we pick it up either the next week or the next Monday, or Tuesday, we will hear the bill again. So with that, good government all the time. We are adjourned. Oh, excuse me, we're not quite adjourned. Representative Rudolph?
I thought you wanted the entire time for dinner tomorrow. My speech was 45 minutes.
You can rewrite that down in a few minutes. We'll go to 42 minutes. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.